The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
And so it begins. Opening weekend of the Premier League sees title favourites winning. Aston Villa, of course, but also Man City and Liverpool. There's shock at Man United Swansea as Monk gets 3 points, none for United. And Bird poops on Ashley Young, saving assembled hacks the bother. Elsewhere, security worries at West Ham as a non-footballer runs on and manages to kick a ball. A club explained Carlton Cole is still their player, though. News elsewhere from around Europe, there's Champions League playoffs and PSG Bastia, Brandao's shocking tribute to Sir Mix-a-Lot, and John Ashton with his eye on the championship. All of that, remarkably, in today's Football Weekly. Hey, everybody, and welcome to a brand new week and a brand new season and a brand new Paolo Bandini back from exotic Missouri in the, you know, the middle America.
Hello, James.
Hi. Howdy.
Howdy. Hey. I wore my best American shirt for you, like, bought from the local cowboy boot store.
Is it genuinely a Missouri original, though?
This is. Well, I don't know if it's... probably, knowing most manufacturing of garments China. All over the world, there's a good chance it's a made-in-China tag somewhere. Right. But yes, it was from a cowboy boot store, though.
Great, great. John, have you got something interesting to tell us about your clothing today?
I think my T-shirt came from Gap.
Did it?
Yeah, which probably was manufacturing the same factory as Paolo's
right.
shirt.
Okay. And Michael Cox?
Yeah, hello.
Because I was looking at I should describe what Michael's wearing. You're wearing, it's kind of, I can imagine Johnny Cash in your shirt. Late period Johnny Cash.
Yeah, you see.
Dark denim, button-down shirt.
Yeah, I bought it 3 months ago, but it's the first time I've worn it, especially for the new season.
Right.
I thought, I bought it and I liked it, and then I looked at it in my wardrobe and I thought it was a bit Kings of Leon.
Oh, Not sure what that means, is she?
Yeah, I'm sceptical about whether that's a good thing.
Right, John?
We should probably just point out to the listeners what you're wearing.
Oh, yeah, what am I wearing?
Which is, what's that Michael Douglas film where he goes nuts?
Yeah, falling down.
Yeah.
Is he wearing this? Yeah, tight black pants smart but kind of stylish short-sleeve white shirt to go with it.
Absolutely.
Hmm. And sneakers to complete the ensemble. listeners, what are you wearing? Anyway, speaking of exciting outfits, there were some top sides on the field on Sunday in the Premier League. And there were all sorts of things to talk about from the opening round of fixtures. But let's begin with the two Sunday games, which was the top two from last season. Michael, you'd arrived fresh off a plane to catch these games. First of all, Liverpool against Southampton, and then Newcastle hosting Man City. What did you make of the Man City Newcastle game?
Well, I thought the two games were actually very similar in the sense that the bigger team kind of laboured to victory. I think there was a common theme across all the big teams this weekend that they looked quite rusty, maybe players coming back from the World Cup. They weren't quite up to sharpness. And I think both Southampton and Newcastle were a touch unlucky, actually. Both had chances to get points from the game. And it was a slightly strange situation afterwards because they interviewed the players and manager from the victorious teams, and they said, well, the performance wasn't great, but, you know, it's all about the result on the first day. And the losing team said, well, you know, we didn't get the result, but the performance was very encouraging. So I'm not sure which way around you're meant to play it, but they were both putting a positive spin on the game. So it seems like all four teams came away from it relatively happy.
Right, okay. Newcastle's new signings look good, and Saints, despite their exodus, looked very competent.
Yeah, the guys that are left there for Ronald Koeman did all right. And the sort of new boys did okay as well. Fraser Forster, I thought, looked good in goal. Tadic was a threat. I think the jury's still out on Graziano Pelé. But, yeah, there's reason for encouragement. But, you know, as long as they can keep what they've got there until the end of the transfer window, because there's still a chance of a few more exits.
Mm. Paolo, as Michael was saying, Saints had chances, but Mignolet proved crucial.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the testament to Southampton, isn't it? They obviously dominated the midfield area a lot of the game, and the fact that Mignolet really, especially right at the end of the game, I think it's like the 88th minute, was an absolutely corking save to keep him in it. So it was, the fact that he's had to have that sort of game is testament to how well Southampton have come out. I mean, as Michael also said, I think Liverpool, like every other big club, looked a little bit rusty.
Well, they did, and you'd wonder as well about the marking that allowed Raheem Sterling, with his questionable haircut, to actually get to that late opportunity and get the winner.
Mignolet is a slightly strange goalkeeper because he consistently makes very good saves. But there's something about his demeanour just looks unconvincing. He always looks very nervous rather than, you know, expect a goalkeeper to be very calm, very solid, very commanding.
Hmm.
He always looks quite shy and...
Doesn't look the part for you.
No, but then once you actually analyse what he's done in a game, he looks very good.
Right, okay. Interesting. Interesting.
There's a fine line there, isn't there? Because we always want goalkeepers to look confident and in control, but as soon as they go... Wojciech Szczęsny on the job and go charging out of their area to clear a ball straight to a opposing player, then suddenly we want them a little bit less confident.
That's
I don't
a good
know. Point. It's always a tricky thing, especially when you're at a club that that is competing for titles, competing for honors. There always tend to be teams that have less chances against them, and you need a different mentality, I think, from that goalkeeper than you do from the goalkeeper who is facing 20 shots a game. I don't know. He's done a good job for them.
Well, he's come from one end of the spectrum to another, hasn't he? From Sunderland to Liverpool. Michael, I know you were quite excited by the Guardian's use of opposable thumbs. They've rated all the new signings with thumbs up and thumbs down.
Yeah, well, it kind of sums up the fact that none of us want to make sweeping conclusions that will be proved wrong within the next few weeks.
Oh.
But there were 45 new signings who were rated with a thumb up,
ooh,
a sideways thumb or a thumb down.
Ooh.
And 29 got a thumbs up.
Right.
15 got a sideways thumb,
ah,
and just one thumb down.
Who was that for? Who was the poor fellow who got the thumbs down?
That was Sunderland's Jack Rodwell.
Really?
I can give you a description, actually.
All right, hang on.
Jack Rodwell looked ring rusty and unsurprisingly ended up substituted.
All right, well, that's
quite damning.
There you go. Wow. Anyway, so Liverpool and Man City got their wins, and there was plenty for the losers to be cheery about from those two games on the Sunday. Let's now rewind a little bit to Saturday and the game which actually kicked off the Premier League season, which was Man United Swansea. Aye, aye, aye. Voila. Even David Moyes could get an opening day win against Swansea.
Well, that's the obvious gag, isn't it? You know, if David Moyes... But if David Moyes did that well in his first game and then went on to do so badly, then obviously Louis van Gaal has made the perfect start to a season.
Right. Okay. Well, it was terrific stuff from Swansea, as a lot of people have pointed out. Their heads didn't drop when Rooney got the equaliser. Sigurdsson had a great game. Nice to see him back at Swansea, no?
Yeah, he just seems to be a good fit there, doesn't he?
Mm.
Sort of happens with players sometimes. I suppose it's difficult to kind of give Swansea the credit because all the focus is on United and their shortcomings. But let's give Swansea some credit.
You have to give some credit for a team that puts together 29 passes before that first goal. I mean, that's something that didn't happen at all last year.
Does it count if you pass back to the keeper in that series?
I think I see where you're coming from. Yes, it's slowing it down. It's not
like one of those 29 passes in the opposition half.
On the other hand, just... think about that, though. It's Old Trafford, and I mean, this is, I suppose, again a comment on Manchester United. Mm. They're allowing you to keep the ball for that long. A few years ago, that would have been unthinkable. The idea that any team, let alone a team like Swansea, yes, even bring it back to its goalkeeper, but would just hold onto the ball for that long and idle with it, and they wouldn't be challenged in that regard in a game which United weren't absolutely smashing them in.
Van Gaal forced to make a major change in his formation midway through the game.
Yeah, I think this three-man defence as an approach is interesting for a team like Manchester United in the Premier League, because you see in Italy, for instance, it's become very popular in the last few years, and you see big teams using it successfully like Juventus, but actually in Italy a lot of teams play with two up top, so it's a very different thing that you're facing. Even small teams are playing two strikers, and when you're playing against two central strikers, it makes sense to have three people there because you can have, if you want it, man on man and one man free. Whereas when you've only got one up against you, as Swansea did, and as most teams coming to Old Trafford realistically are going to have, it seems wasteful. It seems like you're not using, you're effectively giving up an extra man back there for no reason. Now, of course, all these formations are more fluid than that, and there are different ways to use them. But it did seem a bit like for him to get 45 minutes into it and abandon it that quickly was maybe some recognition that it wasn't a very effective and a very efficient use of personnel for this game.
Right, well, then he went to two centre-backs or four at the back, and that wasn't any better. So it's more the personnel.
Well, there is a person. I mean, you know, you've got to look at partly the injuries they've got. You know, obviously no Luke Shaw, no Johnny Evans, no Raphael. That defence is missing people.
Right.
There was a part of me that looked at it and thought, sure, you can make the case that Ferdinand Cvirtic, Edvard, all these players are not the players that they once were. But I do think there's a continuity issue when you get rid of three senior players like that all in one summer. And that's going to be the true in whatever formation you're using.
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, it's true that at the moment, both with the injuries, with those players gone, that doesn't look like a very good defence.
No, it's Phil Jones screaming around trying to make last-ditch tackles all over the shop. It really didn't. Alex says, if Moisey played Lingard and Young as wing-backs with Janetai and Kagawa on the bench, someone would have flown an aeroplane into his house. It's probably true, actually. It may all change with players coming back from injury and, of course, transfers, John.
Yeah, well, they've got time to bring in a couple of names, although the need for that has been sort of heightened. I suppose there's two ways you can look at it. You could either say, oh, it shows Van Gaal's flexibility to switch from 3-5-2 to 4-4-2. What a brilliant sort of flexible manager is, not stuck in his ways, etc. and so forth. Or you could say, well, this is the formation that I've been working on for the entirety of pre-season. This is the way that he's sort of set out to play. This is the way he wants to play. And it really didn't work.
Mm.
But then, yeah, as Paolo says, Luke Shaw to come in, Marcos Rojo, the Argentinian right back.
Is that going to happen?
It seems seemingly likely, I think.
Mm.
You know, put those two into that team and it improves it. But yeah, I mean, you look at the 11 that they named and compare it to sort of the other 11s kind of named elsewhere in the Premier League this weekend. It's about the 7th or 8th best 11 or something like that. There's not that prospect.
You didn't look at that starting lineup and think, oh, it's Manchester United and they're about to flatten someone, did you? It just looked like an average team.
It's funny because there have been a lot of talk about them bouncing straight back up again this season, which, I think the team sheet maybe came as a bit of a surprise to some observers. We're ignoring perhaps the major story of this game, which was the extraordinary sight of a bird pooping in Ashley Young's mouth. Of course, popularly, it's regarded as good luck if a bird poops on you, but it didn't seem to improve his afternoon any.
No, he got moved to left-back in the second half in a back four and I think was culpable for the second goal.
Mm.
So not very good luck at all.
Very much not. Very much not. I know, Michael, you were admirably just saying nobody wants to rush to conclusions after just one game and that, but it's quite handy if you would right now just extrapolate what you expect for Man United over the next month or so from this.
I think they've got a very gentle introduction to the season. Obviously, that's maybe not so positive when you lose at home to Swansea.
Right.
But they've got five more games, of which three are against the newly promoted teams. Huh. So you think they'll probably get the house in order before they take on the big boys. I expect two or three decent new signings.
Mm.
And they had so many players out. Yeah, I don't think there'll be big names. But
This time last year, you probably expected two or three decent signings as well, didn't you?
From United.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is true. And ended up with just Fellaini.
Right.
Yeah. But I think they'll finish top four, but won't
really
challenge for the title. Yeah,
it's top four, Michael Cox.
Can I ask if you think they'll finish top four, who do you think is coming out?
I think Liverpool will find it difficult just because of the Champions League,
yeah,
the extra games, and they haven't got, you know, you look at their team on Sunday, and it was just no Suarez, just screamed out at you. Lallana's coming back. Markovic will come in, but I think their team's weakened.
There is a question for United of, you know, if you start, you know, again, one game, let's not go way overboard, but the longer a bad start goes on, I suppose only a couple more weeks can go on, does that then start to, first of all, make any player who's thinking, well, I'll go there with the thought that I'll play in the Champions League next season, question it? And does it also make, probably more likely, in my view, agents think to themselves, well, The more desperate they are, the more we can demand something unreasonable in wages and everything else. I think it weakens their bargaining position at the very least to look like a team that's floundering at the beginning of the season.
Sound point, Paolo. All right, well, let's just play a little bit of music to clean everyone's palate, and then we'll be back with another exciting matchup from Saturday, which was Arsenal against Crystal Palace.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
Well, as you say, Michael Cox, a lot of the big teams struggling. Arsenal, you'd have to file them in that category, as they were only able to snatch a win right at the death against a Crystal Palace side who we'd been promised were going to be in disarray without Tony Pulis. Quite a story, that, first of all, that broke after our season preview with the manager of the year departing from Palace, so 2 days before the start of the campaign, John.
Yeah, and the reasons remain slightly mysterious, don't they? Mm-hmm. Because the Palace chairman, Steve Parrish, has come out and said it's not about transfer rows, which seemed the obvious kind of link to make.
Right.
So do we believe him or do we not believe him? You're looking at me like you don't believe him.
Well, I just think there's a conflict personality type thing. I don't know. I would imagine probably to do with the whole transfer business. But who's it going to be now then? What's the latest on that?
The front run. Well, they've been having preliminary talks over the weekend. You've got names like Steve Clarke,
really?
Roberto Di Matteo has been mentioned. Malky Mackay was the initial front runner.
Yep.
But the most impressive candidate, apparently, that Palace spoke to over the weekend was one Tim Sherwood.
Tim Sherwood.
Handily enough, they do sell GAs in the Palace shop.
Right. There you go. That's another box ticked. I'd be quite excited about that from a purely neutral point of view, but those all sound like excellent choices. Excellent choices. Clearly, Crystal Palace, the wheels haven't fallen off just because Tony's left town. They acquitted themselves quite well at the Emirates.
Yeah, they did. And again, in keeping with all the other big clubs we talked about, Arsenal didn't look great. They were rusty. There was a lot of bad passing going on. Alexis Sanchez did not have the sparkling league debut that everyone was hoping for, although he did get an assist. There was a lot of... it looked to me with him like there was a lot of just not quite getting his teammates' runs yet. There was a lot of balls that when you looked at them, you could see what he was thinking, but whoever he was playing the ball to wasn't thinking the same thing, and so this ball would run through to nothing. So, you know, Arsenal obviously have a lot of cobwebs to blow off, but
they've got some big players to come back as well.
Literally, Per Mertesacker, they're thinking may have to come back as soon as Tuesday night for the game against Besiktas, which is much sooner than they were hoping. But with Koscielny, it's got a bit of an Achilles problem. He may have to be rushed in there. But Palace were very effective in what they wanted to do. I don't think it was a performance as ambitious as, say, Swansea against Manchester United, but they had a perfectly sensible and workable game plan. I thought Marouane Chamakh, of all people, was an absolute key cog in it. He was playing in a much deeper role than Arsenal ever used him in. He was playing in this sort of almost the notional trequartista between the lines, and he was almost at some points looking more like a midfielder because he was getting back and tackling and winning the ball and dragging them forwards. And they really didn't look like losing that game after they'd taken the lead. The Arsenal goals, both of them felt like they came in just idle, not moments when it was like an overwhelming pressure, just idle moments. There was the free kick from Sanchez that picked out Koscielny, great header, terrible marking by Palace. That was the one thing where they really did get things wrong on the day. And then the goal at the end, it hadn't felt like it was inevitable that Arsenal were going to score. It just happened. So a good performance from Palace, but you need to think they've spent a lot of time preparing for that game, and now with no manager, how do they prepare for the next game? And so it's a very different setup going forward.
Do you think it was significant, Paolo, that Sanogo was preferred to Giroud up front?
Of course, it's significant. I don't know what to make of it, honestly. I don't know if it's a question of Arsenal have a lot of games coming up and they thought that Crystal Palace was the one where maybe you keep Giroud out so he's fresh to play Besiktas, and then you've got Everton, then you've got Besiktas again. Or does Wenger hold him in higher esteem than right now, I would say, many Arsenal fans hold him? I don't get the impression that anyone outside the club is especially convinced by him at the moment. It was an okay performance. At times he was muscular and rangy in that way that he is, but his touch is not great. He doesn't seem to be very good at putting himself in those positions that strikers need to get themselves into to get the final touch on something. So I don't know what he is great at yet. Maybe that's just a question of nerves and youthfulness, and we'll see. But we'll see.
All right. Philip Flanagan would like to know, is Jack Wilshere the most overrated English player at the moment?
Quite possibly. I don't know. He wasn't good again against Palace, and he hasn't been great. Certainly when you compare, because it's easy to do, because they were both coming through at the same time, his rise to Ramsey's, and especially with Ramsey going through an injury in the middle of it, it's very, very different career trajectories at the moment. And, right. and Wilshere gave away the ball a lot at the weekend, and he was taken off as a result.
Kids, don't smoke cigarettes. I think that's the message we can draw from this. Well, Arsenal taking on Besiktas then in the first leg on Tuesday, I think they're playing, of this Champions League qualifier. Very exciting game. I'm ever so pumped about this. Besiktas, excitingly managed by Slaven Bilic these days, and they can also count on the offensive talents of one Demba Ba. Demba Ba, who's already proved crucial to them, scoring a hat-trick that knocked Feyenoord out of a previous preliminary round of this Champions League qualifying business. So obviously, the side from Istanbul, no pushovers, John. Yeah, John's nodding because I've nailed that one. Well, we'll see what happens on Tuesday when Arsenal take on Besiktas. I mean, they always sail through these games, don't they, Arsenal? Do they?
They had a nervous one against Udinese about 3 years ago. But otherwise, usually they wobble away from home and then are quite convincing at home, which away in Turkey you can kind of see happening again.
I think the first leg's at home. Is that right? Or are they away? The first leg's away.
Yeah. Well, away in Turkey is kind of your classic European version of a wet Tuesday in Stoke, isn't it?
Almost? Yeah, yeah.
I think the difficult place to go.
Do you think that's what in Europe? Do they look at any Premier League stars and go, "Yeah, they're very good," but could they do it on a hot midweek night in Istanbul?
Maybe.
That's by no means the only Champions League playoff that's happening this midweek. You've also got Celtic against Maribor, controversially, because Celtic, to be fair, and please don't take this the wrong way, Scottish football fans, but they really shouldn't be there, should they? John?
Rules are rules, Jimbo. Rules are rules.
It's awfully harsh.
I mean, it is very harsh.
Yeah. So, Legia Warsaw, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, they kept the player out for the required number of... Their player was suspended, so they didn't play him in a certain number of games. They just didn't do the paperwork right on those matches. And for that, they've been thrown out of Europe.
That's right.
Yeah. Celtic, anyway, taking on Maribor. They warmed up for that with a whopping 6-1 win over Dundee United in the always competitive... SPL. Rangers ladies, meantime, beat Falkirk FC 22-0 to reach the Scottish Cup quarterfinals in a game that featured hat-tricks for six different players. Their male counterparts were also playing Falkirk, and they only managed two. That was in the Scottish Championship.
What, two hat-tricks?
No, I think just two goals, disappointingly. A 2-0 win, I'm told. Elsewhere in those Champions League qualifiers, you've also got Porto taking on Lille, Copenhagen taking on Bayer Leverkusen. Leverkusen also scored six this weekend. Five of them came from one man, Stefan Kiesling. Boom. Wow, that's going to be a tasty-looking game. And Napoli take on Bilbao.
Yeah, it's probably the tie of the round. It's the one which Bilbao are definitely the team that Napoli were hoping to avoid, I suspect. Good chance that Napoli are the team that Bilbao were hoping to avoid, given Napoli's, Napoli, despite not going through, were probably the best Italian team in the Champions League last season because they actually beat three good teams at home and unfortunately were in an extremely tough group. They've had a frustrating summer. They haven't really got the signings that they wanted to get. I'm going to completely maul his name, Koulibaly at the back, being the one significant signing, but they haven't got the midfielder they want, and now there's this anxiety about if you don't win this game, then obviously all the millions that go with it, what happens to the team. But I do think it's going to be a good Napoli team when you think how they did last season and then the number of signings they made last summer. This is now 12 months on. Everyone's had time to get to know each other better. I mean, they should be very competitive despite the signings.
Michu coming in up front to possibly partner Higuain or sit behind him.
I don't know. I'll be interested to see if he starts in this game or not. I mean, you certainly could see the way that Napoli play. They don't normally play with two up front, so the role for him would have to be behind the attack, but Hamzik often fills that role, so we'll see if he's straight in the team or if he's on the bench, but he's certainly a potential to slot in there somewhere at some point over the two legs.
Right, okay.
I'm looking forward to people on Twitter telling you both off for calling Athletic Bilbao Bilbao rather than Athletic.
Right.
Because they get very shirty about that.
Really?
Athletic Bilbao do. In fact, I've done it there. Athletic do. They get annoyed about it, yeah.
Right.
They put people right.
So you're not supposed to use Bilbao at all?
No, it's Athletic Club. Oh. Which I think is completely unreasonable, because if you're talking about, if you're standing outside Charlton's ground and you say, oh yeah, Man United have signed Herrera from Athletic, you need to add Bilbao, otherwise people think you're an idiot.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Have some of that, Bilbao. Now, one or two other bits to mention from Europe. Very excitingly, it's the first leg of the Spanish Super Cup this week. which will see Atletico take on Real. Luis Suarez is now being allowed to play or train with his Barcelona teammates and send texts to footballers and that kind of thing. Quite extraordinary that his text to Liverpool was front page news for a lot of news outlets. Didn't you think, John?
Yeah, well, it's
a bit of a non-story.
It is really, yeah. I mean, what would you expect? Of course he's going to say,
right,
be nice. I mean, he didn't have a falling out or anything.
Right.
I don't know. Obviously, he's not going to be nice, is he? It's Luis Suarez. He's going to be awful.
Why?
Not evil. He's the biting, World Cup-ruining supervillain, isn't he?
He's a sweetheart. He is. Anyway, in Germany, Javi Martinez could be out for the whole year after he did his cruciate ligament in the German Super Cup. A lot of Super Cup action going on at the moment. That's rotten news for Bayern, isn't it?
Yeah, he's an excellent player. He didn't always play last year for Bayern, which was surprising, as I thought he seemed a perfect kind of Guardiola player. But I think he's brilliant, can play anywhere. And yeah, I've rarely seen him have a bad game. He's a very good player.
Right. And Rafael Honig, I'm very excited to see Wolfsburg signing Nicky Bentner. That's a big move for the Bundesliga there. And in France, Paris Saint-Germain played Bastia, and all sorts of things happened. For a start, Ibrahimovic, who's beginning to get a bit old, he admits he's going to finish his career at PSG, and this particular game finished very early for him. He came off in the first half with a sort of strange abdominal strain after he kind of twisted to get free of his marker and then had to come off the field. The big story, though, there was a 2-0 win for Paris Saint-Germain. The big story, though, was what happened afterwards when Brandao, you probably saw the footage from PSG's security camera, did you not? No. Brandao of Bastia, basically, after he leaves the field, he stands and he waits in the tunnel. And then when Thiago Motta comes off, he walks over to him, headbutts him, breaks his nose, I believe, and then runs away. Terrible, Michael.
It was. It's the worst running away I've seen since
Valencia.
Was it Navarro?
I think it might have been.
Navarro was an unused substitute,
right,
and raced onto the pitch at the end of an Inter-Valencia game.
Yep.
And sucker punched Badiso and ran away straight away. And he had a few Inter players chasing him and attempting some Mortal Kombat style karate kicks.
There was a whole bunch of Inter players and he kind of ran around the back of them.
So yeah, unseen. It was a bit like Thomas Müller's goal against Brazil in the semi-final.
Right.
Where everyone went near post and Müller peeled back far post. It was basically the same move right out of the a training ground textbook.
Yeah, obviously something they'd worked on. Good. The headbutt this week, though, the PSG taking a very strong line. They say they're not going to press charges, but the PSG president, Nasser Al-Khelaifi, says that Brandao should be banned for life. You have to believe he's going to get a very long suspension.
Yeah, well, it's assault, isn't it? He should press charges, really.
Certainly is. Something about Thiago Motta seems to wind up other players, though. Anyway, not that in any way you can
speaking of Mortal Kombat, that was on telly last night.
The film. With Jean-Claude Van Damme.
No, you're thinking of Street Fighter.
I am thinking of Street Fighter.
Mortal Kombat, the movie's got Christopher Lambert in.
Christophe Lambert?
Yeah.
Right.
He's Raiden in a weird white haircut. Right. It's one of the worst films I've ever sat down and watched. I watched that on the back of watching my other half was away for the weekend, so...
Right. Was that your beat 'em up of choice then, Mortal Kombat?
No, I was always much more of a Street Fighter.
I wasn't either. I preferred the polygon based thrills of Tekken.
Oh, interesting, right, interesting choice.
John, let's talk about happier things and the Championship.
Let's.
All right, I'm going to say to you, Bournemouth and Millwall are setting the pace with 6 points from their opening games.
I know, unbelievable. I mean, I looked at the Championship at the start of the season, and usually you can look at the table and think, oh, there must be sort of 20-odd teams, all with reasonable expectations of being in the top six come the end of the season. And I looked at the table this year before the season started, and you think, actually, there's probably a group of six or seven. Cardiff, Forest, Derby, Norwich, Watford, Wigan and Fulham, the other relegated team. That are probably that little bit stronger than everyone else. And of course, Bournemouth and Millwall, after only two games, there's only two teams with 100% records.
Right.
And they are Bournemouth and Millwall, who most people would have put down, I think, for bottom half, if not relegation fights.
All right, well, Millwall, of course, are just beating Fulham. Now, Fulham's record under Felix Magath is actually quite abysmal.
Yeah, well, they've lost two out of two.
Since he arrived,
he's taken them down and you know, now I think they're just sort of outside the bottom three of the fledgling table. I mean, you look at the team that they put out at the weekend, and It's not very recognisable, you know, compared to the one of last year. It's very young. Of the 14 players that McGath used at the weekend, he had a 17-year-old, three 18-year-olds, two 20-year-olds and two 21-year-olds, which is, what's that, eight players that are 21 and under. And I think it's commendable that Fulham are looking to go that way, and they've obviously got that great youth team that came runners-up in the Youth Cup last year. I think it's a really positive thing for them to do, but it's such a tough division to kind of bring all those players through at once. You do need a bit of grit there. They've still got, you know, Scott Parker and Hugo Rodallega, I suppose. But, you know, you wonder how long they'll continue with that if the results kind of press them into kind of taking a slightly different route.
Right. The other two relegated sides, Cardiff and Norwich, faring a bit better. Cardiff got a 3-1 win over Huddersfield, who don't have a manager. Norwich beat Watford 3-0. Sammy Hippier is now in charge at Brighton, and he got, he's got no points so far.
Yeah, Brighton are struggling. They're one of four teams that haven't won a game yet, or haven't got a point yet.
Right.
Along with managerless Huddersfield, who sacked their manager after a 4-0 defeat at home on the opening day.
Right. Right. Michael, were you indicating that you wanted to...
No, I was just going to say that you mentioned a couple of times like the two teams who are top of the table and those are above the relegation zone. Am I right in saying there never used to be league tables until after three games have been played? And now they're published after the first game.
Ha!
So it probably sums up something, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
Thirst for...
What about Blackpool? They've got no players, John.
No, it's been a right mess. They've had a flurry of signings just before the season started.
Oh, they did, right.
Yeah, so they've actually got... Well, the first game of the season, I think they were able to name a squad of 15, so there was a gap on the bench.
Mm-hmm.
But they're nailed on, I think, to...
Oh, really?
I think, you know, you bring in all those players at once, and they're kind of... It was very much kind of, we need to get bodies through the door in order to put a team out. It wasn't kind of necessarily a structured recruitment process at all. It was just, we need people, otherwise we're going to have to play, you know, the youth team, pretty much. So, I mean, who knows? Maybe there'll be a sort of us against them mentality and everything will turn out rosy for them. But there's a lot of pressure on the board. The fans are, you know, understandably, I think, pretty unhappy with Carl Oyston, the owner, who's not invested kind of post-premiership days. They're going to struggle.
That sounds hideous. What about Nottingham Forest? How's Stuart Pearce doing?
Yeah, they got a 2-2 draw against Bolton at the weekend, having won on the opening day.
On Tuesday, they're going to take on table-topping Bournemouth.
Are they?
Yeah, they are.
To the fixture. Mm. Well, I suppose the good news for Forest coming out of this weekend was that Britt Asombalonga, their record... Is he their record signing or... One of the most expensive players ever signed in the championship.
How much did he cost?
They paid $5.5 million for him from Peterborough. He scored a lot of goals last year. He got two. He got a brace at the weekend, which is, I suppose, a quick return on the investment.
Certainly is.
Actually, the you know, we talking of Fulham, they've actually got the most expensive championship player ever signed in Ross McCormack, who didn't start at the weekend.
Ooh. Elsewhere in the Football League, John, you went to Kenilworth Road this weekend, did you?
I did, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, it was the first, you know, Luton back in the league, first time in 5 years, and it was the return of league football to old lady Kenilworth. And unfortunately, they lost 1-0 to AFC Wimbledon, but it was quite a nice occasion. It was absolutely packed. There was over 9,000 there,
right,
which is quite impressive for League Two.
Right. The other Wimbledon, by the way, they've just drawn MK Dons, I'm referring to. They
can't call them the other Wimbledon.
Well, the original Wimbledon.
No, they can't call them the original Wimbledon either.
The body-snatching Wimbledon. That one? The cuckoo Wimbledon. We call them that? Anyway, Bizarro Wimbledon, says producer Ben. They're going to be hosting Man United in the Capital One Cup at the end of the month. That's exciting, isn't it? A bit of League Cup news here. Potentially. Here's a random question. Tom Howard tweets in, how do the guys think Conte will do as the manager of Italy? That means your Football League chat is over, by the way, John. Paolo.
That means my Italian football chat is opening up.
Well, I don't know if you're having one per se, but Antonio Conte, Azzurri?
Yeah, I think he's... I think he's obviously... You couldn't have asked for a better appointment. I think he's a great manager, and there's good reasons to think that he will succeed there. The question that everyone is asking at the moment is, because his contract is in substantial part being funded by a Puma sponsorship arrangement.
So 5.5 million euros a season, 2 million of which are coming from Puma?
Yeah, and I think that's right. it's uncomfortable, isn't it? You know, is he going to be under pressure to select Puma branded
players?
Mario
Balotelli is a Puma player. Can he drop him?
Yeah. I mean, my purely personal expectation on this is I can't imagine knowing Antonio Conte, knowing the sort of manager he is, the sort of ruthlessly single-minded character that he is, that he would be willing to kowtow to a sponsor and would be swayed by that. But we'll see, is the answer. I think
Antonio Conte's past has shown one or two brushes with kind of managerial rail politic, which don't necessarily suggest that he's an idealist through and through. But you know, that aside, we've seen plenty of other national sides who have kowtowed to pressure from sponsors in the past. I mean, Brazil is the first example that springs to mind, and that's without a massive contract, a personal contract of this nature. So it's the question of if the Italian FA want to extend the contract, or if they want to bring in a new manager, do they have to negotiate with Puma first? How does it work?
Well, I don't know the ins and outs of that. I've wondered that. What if it were to go disastrously and they wanted to get shot of him? How would that work out? Mm. I don't know. There's lots of grey area there. It's certainly raises awkward questions that no one has answered. But I mean, there's unfortunately lots at the top of Italian football, questions that aren't being well answered at the moment, and this is just another one of them. But purely in terms of a manager who could do well in international football, I think Conte has the right credentials for it. He's very good at working with individual players, and he's very good at creating that mentality, which I think is required all the more so in international football, where you have less time to work with players, just the mentality of us against them and let's go out and do it, which frankly Italy have had the best results when it's been us against the world and go on a crusade and think everyone's out to get you.
He's certainly intense. His appointment was seen as a real coup for the new head of the Italian FA, which is ordinarily a fairly dull topic to bring up, except for the fact that this is Carlo Tavecchio, who 2 or 3 days before the appointment said some really stupid things about players coming in from abroad.
He made a crass comment about foreign players of particular skin colours and bananas, which is just exactly the sort of thing that you absolutely don't need in a country that already has, just, you know, aside from football, Italy has all sorts of complicated relationships with race that aren't good and aren't things that you want Italian football to be dwelling on or setting a poor example on. Yeah, it's not great. They had an election, and that was he was the one who more Italian owners felt comfortable with than Albertini, who was standing against him. It's a situation that looks very bad for Italian football, and which I think is bad for Italian football. But that's the decision that they made.
Right. Well, a somber note, Paolo, but a necessary one. And let's now take a little break, and then we'll be back with more from the Premier League. Producer Ben has a request, John, that you name once again Nottingham Forest record signing, because he really enjoyed hearing you say it.
Britt Asombalonga.
There you go. I bet you'd have even more fun saying it. Britt Asombalonga. Try it at home.
Mangled that, Jimbo.
What?
That wasn't as good as... Forget it. No, I'm sorry.
What was
I was going to say it wasn't as good as me, and then I realised what I was saying.
Yeah, so it wasn't as good. Stop. You did it better. Yeah. No, you did that better, to be sincere, John. Give me one more.
Britt Asombalonga.
Yeah.
Sounds nice better name. In that kind of northern.
What's your favourite name in football, Michael?
There was a player for Venezia once, probably when you were over there.
Perhaps.
But called Federico Magallanes.
Ah, yeah, the Brazilian fellow, I think, wasn't he? Or was he Uruguayan or something?
I think he was Uruguayan. Played up front with Maniero.
Oh, yeah, Pippo Maniero. Yeah. The kind of the Eric Cantona light.
Yeah.
He looked a little bit like Cantona, wore his collar up to accentuate the resemblance.
I've no idea what happened to Magallanes.
Right.
But it was a lovely name.
Okay. I was saying last week that I really enjoyed Johnny Two Saints, Giovanni Dos Santos, but only if there's some real sports tweet in saying that I translated his name wrong, but I don't care. Paolo, do you have a favourite name in football?
Well, it's a bit of a name that I don't really have the context for, but Paul Doyle introduced me to the player from Zaire, Christ Bongo. which remains a tremendous name. I don't think he's still there.
I think you win that one. Christ Bongo. Now, the Premier League. There's some other very exciting games that didn't involve necessarily title contenders, but we've still got a lot for them. Leicester Everton. Leicester fielding their brand new striker, Ujua. John, you've got a rule about promoted team strikers, is that right?
Yeah, well, it's more about promoted teams, really, that I always think that to give yourself a chance of staying up, you have to spend £12 million on a pair of strikers.
Okay.
And Leicester did most of that on one, who scored straight away.
He did.
Despite not having a particularly good game, I don't think. And one of the guys that they were, you know, there was some talk about him leaving the club, Chris Wood, scored the equaliser late on as well.
Right. Good draw for them, that. 2-2 at the King Power.
Yeah, very good result. Given that Everton played pretty well. Yeah, there was a lovely McGeady goal was probably my favourite of the weekend, I think.
Right. That's fair. Would you go along with that, Michael?
It wasn't my favourite of the weekend, but
what
it was very
good. What was your favourite of the weekend?
My favourite of the weekend was... it was mainly for the cross by Craig Gardner for West Brom. He flitted a lovely ball to the back post for Berahino's goal.
All right,
I thought it was just a brilliant, brilliant cross.
Paolo?
I did like McGeady, because when you saw the angle on it, there's like five, maybe six players between him and the goal, and there's just nothing to aim at all, but there's this, except that tiny pocket in the top corner. I don't know, it was just so, you had to be so precise to put it there, and he did.
Mm. Lovely. Bad news for Everton, meantime, as Ross Barkley, they're going to get, I think, a more definitive idea on how long he's going to be out for this midweek, but they're talking about 5 months.
Yeah, and that would be a huge blow for them, obviously. Naismith, I think, Stephen Naismith, played in that kind of hole at the weekend and scored. But, you know, it was kind of going to be a big... It felt like it was going to be a big season for Barkley, a proper run at a full season with, you know, Lukaku permanently there ahead of him sort of thing. And, it's a real shame that it's going to be out till Christmas by the sounds of it.
Right. Everton talking to Samuel Eto'o, apparently, about possibly joining that. That would be an interesting move. West Brom, meantime, also a 2-2 draw for them as they got a point against Sunderland. Saida Berina with both goals. How get the win at Loftus Road? Very much blame it on Rio, this one.
Just to be difficult, I'm not going to blame it on Rio, because everyone else likes to blame everything on zonal marking. I'm going to blame it on man marking.
Right.
It was all man marking's fault. We don't blame individuals, we just blame the person who happened to be marking the player.
Mm.
It's a terrible
or
system.
Or not, indeed, yeah. Indeed so. How about Villa's win at Stoke? I hope Ding they win for Villa. That surely presages big things for the club. Oh, hang on. Last season they won at Arsenal, didn't they? Still, a lot of people are very excited about this, with the return to the fold of all those players that they'd frozen out because they wouldn't take pay cuts or something. How did that work? Alan Hutton and Shea Given and that? It's interesting how all this story is being more widely publicised now, with Alan Hutton saying that he was effectively frozen out by Randy Lerner because he wouldn't take his wages were too high. They were trying to move him out, and Shea given a similar thing. So Villa's last season was an extraordinary bit of mismanagement read in that light.
You know, to sort of pick up on that, they did look like a very solid defensive unit with Hutton on one side and Sissoko on the other, and even Philippe Senderos played well. You know, again, bizarre that he's managed to pick up another Premier League club, but yeah, it looks. That's the thing with Senderos, isn't it? You'll get one good game, and then he'll make a couple of clangers later on. And
well, that was what Ian said on the last pod. You know, a great defender for 88 minutes, and maybe he didn't get challenged in the 89th this time. But I don't know. I mean, him and Ron Vlaar played well at the weekend. I will sit back and hold judgment on that partnership a little while longer before we make any sweeping decisions.
I quite like the fact that it's a very hairless central defensive partnership. It's good to see that. In a world of David Luiz's and Colaccini's playing at centre-half, good to see some proper baldies.
Yeah, very nicely done. Of course, Roy Keane on the bench, he brings the hair, doesn't he? A lot of people pointed to his presence as to the why that Villa rediscovered their intensity. Do you buy that, Michael?
No, but I think there's a good chance that he'll take over from Lambert.
Again, what Ian McIntosh was saying, but I don't know. West Ham Spurs, to finish off, West Ham Spurs. Aye, 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 West Ham.
Got to score your penalty, Mark Noble. That was the obvious turning point in the game. It's not a particularly insightful thing for me to say, but it's true. If he scores that penalty, it's a different game. But I don't know. I mean, it didn't strike me that, in keeping with just about every other game we've talked about, it didn't strike me that that either team looked fantastic, but I did feel like West Ham were the better side for a large stretch of the game, probably in part because they were man up for most of the game.
Well, but that's the thing. The penalty is not the only opportunity they didn't take, I think a lot of the fans felt.
Sure.
They had a man advantage and they could have made more of that.
Yeah, and that's probably true. Lloris made a couple of very good saves. There was one, I think it was Noble again, who came clean through and very nearly lifted it over him in the middle.
Mm.
So they did have other chances. Yes, I think that's a fair comment. Maybe they should have done more. I know Jacob Steinberg in his report of the game was talking about it just looked like a classic Allardyce team performance, and there was a lack of different ideas to these crosses from deep, and there was no variation in the game after they went after their man up, and they didn't have any sort of great idea of how to press home their advantage. And he raised the fact that Mauro Zárate was sitting on the bench and they didn't bring him on. I don't know with Zárate, after watching him for 5 years, 6 years in Italy, I don't think that's a player who's ever going to live up to the hype and the potential that was once there. But certainly, it seems that from the perspective of someone who's spent a lot of time watching the club in Jacob, it seems like that he was hoping to see something different,
right?
And didn't.
Well, that was the thing with West Ham. I mean, you know, you watch Match of the Day, and it's quite confusing to see all the team sheets with new players, and it's almost too much information to take in. And then the West Ham game came up, and they were playing Colt and Cole up front, Kevin Nolan getting on the second balls, and Vazte coming in from the left. It's just you can't blame West Ham fans for just being sick of watching the same old thing.
Well, the change they might get on their team sheet very soon is at the bottom, that the manager's name coming in under huge pressure, and this game won't have helped that very much. One fellow who did come on and struck the ball very sweetly, of course, was that random fan. I was really impressed with that. He ran the entire length of the field and perfectly took that free kick. I mean, it didn't go in, but it was a decent strike, wasn't it?
Considering the length of the distance of his run in a pair of jeans,
yeah,
under pressure as well. From stewards.
I don't know. Yeah, to get that would have been quite a story if, you know, scouts went out to sign him up, wouldn't it?
The goalkeeper saved it. That was the disappointing thing.
Oh, yeah.
He's also probably now going to have a sort of 2-year banning order from football, so
right.
Signing him would have to be a long term.
It'd be like Luis Suarez, who's banned from all football activities.
It's not like he bit anyone. I read, that would be lovely if a club came in. We could do a kind of reality TV show around that. Anyway, big pressure for Big Sam and all sorts of other excitements from the opening weekend. But as Michael says, let's not look at the table for at least another couple of weeks. We've got European action coming up Tuesday and Wednesday, so we'll be back talking about that on Thursday. Hopefully we'll also hear from Sid Lowe as he wrecks the first leg of the Spanish Super Cup and looks forward to the opening round of the Liga this weekend. Barry should be returning from his various duties elsewhere as well for Thursday's show. So you might want to stop by and listen to that. In the meantime, many thanks and welcome back to Paolo Bandini.
Cheers.
Cheers to John Ashdown. And many thanks also to Michael Cox and producer Ben. And you, listener, have a great week. We'll see you again on Thursday.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.